You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a new investigation finds that a nonprofit group lobbying for the dairy industry paid millions of dollars to executives while farmers struggled. A reporter shares the story coming up. First, Marquette University unveiled new rules regulating how students, staff, and faculty can protest on campus. Among the changes, protesters would need advance permission to demonstrate on certain parts of the campus, and the university could record and take photos of participants and charge them for any cleaning that needs to be done after the event. Critics of the new policy say this could hamper free speech on campus and took issue with the announcement of the policy. After the criticism, Marquette officials said they would review the new policy. Our next guest is here to talk about the rules, possible changes, and how they fit into other free speech issues on campuses across the nation. Catherine Mangan is a senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you talk about what was in this policy that had faculty and staff worried?
Yeah, well, the way the policy was rolled out, first of all, concerned people. It was announced in a newsletter over the summer that was overlooked by a lot of people. And when they caught wind of it, some of the provisions were upsetting to various faculty and students. Basically, it said that if students wanted to hold a demonstration anywhere other than in the student union or an adjacent green space, that they'd have to first get approval from the dean of students as well as a permit. And faculty who wanted to demonstrate would also need approval from the provost, and staff would have to go to the vice president for human resources. And there was a very lengthy list of requirements that would sort of outline what kinds of demonstrations would and wouldn't be allowed. And many of them just sort of raised red flags with people who felt that these were just unnecessarily restrictive.
In the rollout of these rules and since this reaction, what have we heard from Marquette administrators about why they wanted to make this change?
Well, they said that they already had a policy that related to, that affected students, and that it just made sense to roll out one that included faculty and staff as well. The goal, I think, was to balance the rights of students and employees to freely express their views, but at the same time to sort of minimize the amount of disruption and any safety concerns.
And a group of faculty members wrote an open letter to the administration about this. What kind of concerns did they raise in that?
The faculty argued that the point of a demonstration is to disrupt. I think one of the things that the faculty objected to was this idea that protests would be allowed, but not if they were disruptive and disrupting the normal operations of a university. And they pointed out that some of the language in the policy made it appear that this policy was, in fact, a reaction to a occupation over the summer. Earlier in the summer, some pro-union employees had occupied an administration building. And during that time, administrators had said things like, well, you can't block the entrances and you can't disrupt normal operations of the university. And of course, you know, those who were protesting would say, in order to be effective, a protest really has to be disruptive.
Talking to Catherine Mangan, senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education, about recently unveiled protest rules at Marquette University, reaction from faculty, staff, and students there, possible revisions on the way, and how it fits into the national landscape. And let's go there now, Catherine. This is not, I mean, in a way, it is an isolated local story, but it's against a backdrop of lots of concerns about free speech and protest on campuses around the country. Set the national scene for us.
Yeah, this is certainly a reflection of a much broader national concern over free speech and also whether too many restrictions are being placed on student demonstrators as a result. I think a lot of the controversy, like in this case, surrounds these so-called free speech zones. And these are small areas where protests are permitted. People who oppose those say that this is essentially quarantining free speech and saying that it's just unnecessarily restrictive to say that students and employees can only protest in one small area of campus. There have been, I think more than 16 state laws that have been passed recently, free speech laws that many of them specifically call out these free speech zones. As a result, some universities have done away with them. Many of these laws, though, have been prompted mainly by critiques from conservative lawmakers who feel that colleges have been too quick to try to sort of protect students from ideas they don't that threaten them. And so, you know, when conservative speakers are disinvited, or students shout down speakers they disagree with, these are the kinds of things that have angered many lawmakers and prompted many of these free speech laws that have been passed over the last year or two.
Now, most people don't work on a college campus, and they might think, hey, wait a minute, I can't protest my employer at my workplace. So what's different about a university or college? Is there something in the mission that makes it kind of a different story as opposed to, say, a private employer?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the points that the faculty make, is that this is supposed to be a marketplace of ideas where this kind of disagreement and at times very loud and angry disagreement should be encouraged, that these are learning opportunities for students and also for institutions. If students and other protesters are calling attention to injustices or problems, the entire university can benefit from allowing them to take place.
And are you seeing an overcorrection in some ways from administrators on campuses to criticism from lawmakers, as you were mentioning earlier? Is the political climate making campus administrators a little more nervous about these issues?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a concern that sometimes campuses are going overboard in their efforts to control some of these demonstrations. And there was certainly a lot of concern when this policy mentioned that campus police officers would be expected to be present when demonstrations occur, and that they could be filming the demonstrations. That has many people worried that this is just really an overcorrection.
One of the concerns raised by faculty and others, getting back to Marquette specifically, was that this came from administrators. There was no input from, apparently, faculty organizations or students. Is that the norm? Are faculty and student groups often involved in a decision-making process like this?
Well, faculty and students usually are, and I think in any case where you have these cases being sort of handed down from the administration, you're going to get a lot of pushback. But it sounds as though Marquette is reconsidering the policy now, and that there may be some revisions coming soon.
Yeah, they plan to re-examine the new policy at an upcoming meeting next week. So what will you watch for as that happens and as we see what comes out after that?
Well, I think this whole idea of having to get a permit before you demonstrate and having to be limited to a specific, very small area of campus, those are issues that I think there's been a lot of pushback on, and I suspect there may be there may be some changes there.
And as you watch at the national level, Catherine, as we wrap up, are you expecting to see more flashpoints when it comes to various issues of free speech on campus?
Yeah, I think this is an issue that isn't going to be going away. I think there's certainly a very a lot of people who feel that this whole talk of a free speech crisis is overblown, that really the First Amendment protects free speech, and that colleges, by their very nature, sort of go out of their way to make sure that people have the right to express a variety of views. But I think that these issues are going to continue to come up, and I think we're going to see more controversies like what we're seeing at Marquette.
Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Catherine Mangan, senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. She joins to talk about Marquette University's protest and demonstration policy. The university announced last week that it would revisit its new rules after criticism from faculty and students. Coming up, a group that boosts the dairy industry is getting criticism from some of the farmers who fund it, with concerns over high pay for executives while many dairy farms go out of business. We'll find out more coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, John Bolton is departing the White House as National Security Advisor, but there's some uncertainty over whether he resigned or was fired. We'll get the latest on that, plus gun legislation in the works during our look at the week in Washington. First, dairy farmers and the milk industry are a big part of Wisconsin's cultural identity and economy. And many dairy farmers are struggling in the state for a number of reasons, ranging from ongoing tariffs to low dairy prices. Some of those dairy farmers are raising concerns about a lobbying group funded by their milk sales. A new investigation from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel found that in 2017, executives at Dairy Management Incorporated made salaries in the high six figures, while more than 500 farms closed in Wisconsin. Carrie Spivak is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Carrie, welcome back to the show.
Oh, glad to be here.
Well, tell us more, first of all, about Dairy Management Incorporated, what it is and how it's funded.
Dairy Management, Inc. is one of, well, there's approximately two dozen checkoff programs for all types of agriculture, ranging from Christmas trees, popcorn growers, beef, pork, and dairy. And the farmers, set by law by Congress, are required to pay a portion of the monies that they receive directly to the checkoff programs. In the case of dairy farmers, it's about, I believe, 15 cents per 100 pound of milk. The job of dairy management and the other checkoff programs is basically to promote and market the farmer's product, and they're not allowed to promote the product of one farmer at the expense of another farmer. In a nutshell, that's what the checkoff programs are. And dairy management is based in Chicago and in Rosemont, right by O'Hare.
And for the public, we might have seen the Got Milk campaigns of celebrities that ultimately came from dairy management. Is that right?
Exactly. And it was dairy management or a predecessor. And that's what all these do. The pork, the other white meat, also came from a checkoff program. So, yeah, they've come up with, if they give them credit, they have come up with over the years some good marketing programs like that. But as we noted in the story, despite the popularity of the Got Milk and the milk mustache, consumption of milk has not gone up since the 80s.
One of the concerns raised by some of the farmers whose milk money effectively funds Dairy Management, Inc., is the pay for executives there. What did you find when you looked at what people are getting paid at the top levels of this milk marketing agency?
I found I entered the wrong profession. These guys are doing pretty good. The CEO, I believe, since 2010, was making, it averages out at over $900,000. Three times he made over $1 million since, I believe, 2013. And when I said make, that's, excuse me, that's salary and the various benefits. Tom Vilsack, the former Secretary of Agriculture, was paid about $800,000 last year, or in 2017. So as a group, they do pretty good.
And you talked to some farmers, including some former members of the board of directors, in effect, this national board, who are worried about that kind of pay given the struggles of dairy farmers. What kind of things did you hear?
Pretty much what you just said. I'm sorry, I'm losing my voice here.
That's okay.
Pretty much what you just said, especially in light of the crisis in Dairyland, the number of farmers going out of business. These guys have not cut their salaries.
We'll give you a moment there, Carrie. We're talking to Carrie Spivak, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Talk about a piece he wrote about Dairy Management, Inc. It's effectively a marketing agency for milk. It's funded under a law from Congress by a required charge from farmers on every 100 weight of milk they sell. Concerns raised by dairy farmers about high pay for executives at this group. Carrie, you got responses from dairy management, I think just from one of their public relations people. What did they say about the issue of what executives there are getting paid?
They did said the same standard type thing that you get in CEO compensation on public companies. They said that if you compare it to, that they always have studies, and if you compare it to other people in the similar type jobs, that they're being paid adequately. However, we found by going to Candid, which used to be known as GuideStar, and they study nonprofits, the salaries for the CEO, the median was more than double the median salary of other CEOs of large nonprofits. And on top of that, the dairy management and all the checkoff programs don't have to do what most CEOs of large nonprofits have to do, which is find money. A CEO of a nonprofit generally spending a good chunk of his or her day raising money. These guys don't have to do it because Congress does it for them, in effect.
And you also compare dairy management to their peer organizations, the ones who promote beef and pork and so on. How does pay at the dairy group stack up against those other comparable agencies?
Again, much higher. Dairy management in 17, the CEO there, Gallagher, made $899,000. The head of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association was 507, and National Pork Producers Councils, which doesn't directly get checkoff money but indirectly does, was about 400,000. So yeah, they do very well against all nonprofits or the nonprofits that are more similar to them.
And at the other end of things, you also compared the effective rate that dairy farmers are paying into this checkoff promotional agency compared to other agricultural resources.
Mm-hmm.
What did you find there?
That the dairy farmers are paying a lot more. It equals out for every $100 of product that they sell. They are paying about 80 cents compared to 40 cents for the pork producers and 7 cents for the beef producers. And that, those couple of graphs of the story were, there's a credit at the bottom for Andrew Malik, who much better than I am at math. He was the one who was able to break that down. And I thought it was a fascinating stat that he came up with.
And you said earlier this agency, the dairy management, is not supposed to favor one kind of producer over another. You heard concerns, though, from smaller farmers that, hey, maybe the larger dairy operations were coming out better from some of the things they did. What kind of things are they talking about?
Yeah, that kind of cuts to the heart of their opposition to it, the smaller farmers. The giant co-ops will benefit much more than from the marketing and what they're doing from dairy management than the smaller family farmers. So they're basically, what they always often say is that they're paying to kill to slash their own throats, or words to that effect. And then there also was a considerable amount of money given to what's it called, Fairlife Milk, to produce that, which is benefiting, and right now is benefiting just one farm operation, and also Coca-Cola, which distributes the product.
As you mentioned earlier, this dairy management is established by Congress. Have there been moves in Congress to change the way all of this works in any way?
There have been three bills. It's an identical bill introduced in the past couple of years. It's pending right now to reform the process, make it more transparent, because right now it's virtually impossible to find out any financial records of these, any detailed records. The information we got all came from, they're called Form 990s, which are the forms that they have to file with the IRS, which are public documents. All nonprofits must file them. And an interesting thing on the bill that's pending right now is it's quite a mix of senators who are sponsoring it. You have Senator Mike Lee, who's a conservative Republican from Utah, Rand Paul from Kentucky, and two Democratic presidential candidates, Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren. So it's kind of crosses the it's definitely nonpartisan. It definitely crosses party lines.
Well, now here's something that just occurred to me as you named off the states they're from. I don't think of any of those states you just mentioned as big dairy producing states.
Yeah, I guess not. Maybe Utah, but there's some dairy in all of those, but yeah, not heavy duty. Definitely not like Wisconsin. And Ron Johnson, the bill, a similar bill was tried to be tacked on as an amendment to the farm bill. That was kind of the test of waters for what type of support there is. Senator Johnson voted in favor of the reform bill, and Tammy Baldwin voted against.
What kind of things did you hear from former board members for the agency, against it, for about changes they might like to see?
One thing that we've heard from quite a few, number one, get more oversight and keep more, even more of the money regionally. Right now they pay 15 cents. A dime stays local. When I say local, it's statewide. And a nickel goes to the national group. And there seems to be a lot of argument for, let's keep it all locally.
you know, there's programs with the NFL, as one former board member said, the NFL doesn't need her money, but do it more local, regional things, and that way you would directly benefit your local farmers.
Of course, the other big part of the story is the struggles of a lot of dairy farms, especially those smaller ones. How many, talk about what kind of situation they're facing in their daily economies.
Oh, it's tough. In fact, this story, if we had done it 5-10 years ago, I don't think it would have had the impact. In 2017, in Wisconsin alone, 503 dairy farms shut down. Nationally, it was 1,600. And it's, you know, every penny counts. I mean, it's not huge, huge dollars they're paying. But if you're on the verge of bankruptcy, it's real money. So, yeah, it definitely has an impact. And the farmers who oppose it do so sometimes for the straight financial reason that I can't afford this. I can use the money for other things, and others for just on a matter of principle.
Now, you heard from go ahead.
No, I'm done. That's fine.
You heard from some farmers who are upset about this, but do you get the sense that there's any kind of movement of farmers there, that they're in any kind of organized way trying to challenge and change things here?
There are various farm groups working together, which represent the smaller independent farms that are lobbying for the legislation. It doesn't sound like it's going to pass anytime soon, but there seems to be more, especially in the dairy industry, farmers speaking out about it. Probably, again, as it's like CEO pay in a public company. If your CEO is making $10 million, but your stock is going up, you'll look the other way. If he's making $10 million and your stock is, you know, plummeting, you're going to be much louder. And right now, the dairy farmers are fighting for survival, so they're being much louder than they were a few years ago.
Kerry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Sorry I lost my voice there for
That's
a minute.
No problem. Kerry Spivak is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We all been there. He joined us on the show today to talk about his recent article on a dairy marketing group funded by milk sales and concerns raised by farmers about high salaries for executives during tough times for producers. Coming up after the news, John Bolton is out as National Security Advisor. We'll find out why and look at what Congress is up to in our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk to an aid worker on Grand Bahama Island about the devastation in the aftermath of Hurricane Dorian. First, we take a look at the week in Washington. Senate Republicans met with President Trump today to gauge his support for expanding firearm background checks. John Bolton is leaving his post as National Security Advisor. And new polling shows that as President Trump's approval rating dips, Americans are feeling more worried about a recession within the next year. Our question for you this week, are you worried about a recession maybe over the next year? Do you think President Trump is setting the economy up for success? Or are you worried about a downturn because of him, in spite of his efforts? Are you worried about a trade war and dueling tariffs on consumer goods with China, how that can affect our national economy and your personal economy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Tolu Olorunipa is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's good to be here, Rob.
Well, let's start with the sort of surprising, non-surprising news of the week so far. John Bolton is out as National Security Advisor. He says he offered to resign Monday night. President Trump says he, in effect, fired Bolton. What do we know about what happened?
Well, we know that there are dueling narratives from the president and his National Security Advisor about what happened. Apparently, there was a falling out over a number of different issues, but specifically in recent days over the president's plan to bring members of the Taliban, leaders of the Taliban, to Camp David to notch a peace agreement over Afghanistan. There was a lot of internal debate about that, and the president was not happy with some of the leaks that came out of the administration about that internal debate and the fact that there were a lot of people who disagreed with the president's decision to bring the Taliban into Camp David. John Bolton has taken a tougher line than the president on a number of different issues. The president has said that he wasn't happy with John Bolton's position on everything from Iran to Venezuela to North Korea, and it seemed like the most recent disagreement over Afghanistan was the straw that broke the camel's back, and now you have John Bolton saying that he quit and he was not fired, and it just seems to be sort of an internal kind of messy situation where the president is having a nasty breakup with one of his top advisors and on Twitter and publicly, and it's not a normal situation where you might have someone resign quietly or say they want to spend more time with their family. It's very much a public dispute and a public spat over policy issues and over policy disagreements.
Here's a listen to President Trump talking about Bolton's departure at the White House earlier today.
He's somebody that I actually had a very good relationship with, but he wasn't getting along with people in the administration that I consider very important. And I hope we've left in good stead, but maybe we haven't, maybe we haven't. I have to run the country the way we're running the country. We're doing very well. We're respected all over the world again.
This is the third national security advisor to leave the Trump administration. That, I think, is a quicker pace than we usually see at this job.
Yeah, this is a pretty fast pace. There's been a lot of turnover within the Trump administration, but this position especially has been marred by controversy. The first national security advisor was caught up in federal investigations and eventually pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his calls with Russian officials. The president had some trouble getting along with his second national security advisor and had some public fighting also with him, H.R. McMaster. He brought in John Bolton, which was somewhat curious because John Bolton is very much a hawk on a number of different issues, and the president campaigned on the idea of getting out of various so-called endless wars that the U.S. has gotten involved in. So it was a curious decision that the president brought in John Bolton. He had seen him a lot on Fox News, but it was clear that there were going to be some personality clashes in that relationship, and it seems like the president has had trouble finding a national security advisor who can stay in the job and who he can sort of have a mind meld with over foreign policy issues. And this is just the latest example of the president having a public falling out with one of his top national security officials and sort of firing the person on Twitter in a public way. The president said he will be announcing the fourth national security advisor next week. So we'll have to wait and see who may end up getting the job next, but it is clear that the president has had trouble finding people who he can agree with and who he can get along with over a long period of time, and that's why we've seen so much turnover in this position.
Talking about some of the top news in national politics this week with Tolu Olorunipa from the Washington Post. I want to move on to something I know you've written about, Tolu. The latest polls on President Trump and Americans' concerns about the future of our economy. This poll was Washington Post and ABC. What jumped out to you here?
The numbers that jumped out to me most was 60%. That's 60% of Americans who expect that the U.S. will be in a recession within the next 12 months. So that is a pretty negative sentiment about where people see the economy and where they see it going. There's a big split because about 56% of Americans say that the economy is good, positive. They view it positively right now, but a large number of those people who think the economy is good now think it's going to take a turn for the worse, and that could really have a negative impact on the president's reelection bid. It could end up being self-reinforcing. If people feel that the economy is going bad, they may end up spending less money, and consumer spending could dip, and that could harm the broader economy. And if that happens, the president's central argument for re-election really takes a hit. He's been talking about the strong economy and talking about how he's been able to, you know, create all of these jobs and bring the unemployment rate low. And if he loses that message, or if the economy slows and he can't make that message as forcefully, it's going to be very difficult for him to run a strong re-election campaign. And another number that jumped out from the poll is that only 38% of Americans approve of the president's job performance. That's down from 44% earlier in the summer, and it comes in part because people are worried over the state of the trade war. They believe that the president has done more to advance the oncoming of a potential recession than he has to stave it off. They believe that his trade war with China is harming the economy, and he's not getting very strong marks for his handling of the economy, which in the past it's been one of his strongest issues. Right now it's more of a mixed bag, with about half of Americans saying they approve of how he handles the economy and half saying they disapprove. And for a president who wants to hang his reelection bid on economic growth, having a mixed bag on that issue is not a good situation for him. So there are a lot of warning signs for the president in this poll that show that the economy may not be the strong issue that he wants it to be going into 2020. And a lot of people are worried and concerned that actually we could see a recession in the next 12 months.
And the president has had kind of a two-part message on the economy. One, it's doing great in large part, he says, because of his reforms and Republicans in Congress. But two, he's saying the Federal Reserve needs to cut interest rate, already low interest rates, even lower. In one tweet, I think he said to 0% or lower to maintain the good economy. Is that a mixed message?
It's a mixed message, in part because the president wants to be able to say that the economy is strong. He does not want people to believe that the economy is not going to be strong. He does actually believe that if people feel that way, that it could be a self-reinforcing situation that causes a recession because people stop spending money. So he's been the number one cheerleader of the economy and cheerleader of himself and his handling of the economy. But at the same time, he's picked out a few scapegoats, including the number one scapegoat for him, the Federal Reserve, and Fed Chairman Jay Powell saying that the Federal Reserve needs to cut rates. It's really an unprecedented intervention into what is normally an independent body, the Federal Reserve, the president trying to force the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates all the way down to zero or even negative interest rates for political reasons or to benefit his political standing or to help him in his trade war with China. The president is choosing that scapegoat in case there is more of an economic slowdown to blame it on the Fed. He's also blamed the media for you know, sparking fears of a recession. So we are seeing this two-track approach with the president saying, you know, he's done a good job with the economy, but also looking for people to blame in the event that the economy slows down further.
Let's bring on a caller on this at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Racine. Chris, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My concern is that, yes, I believe Trump is going to harm the economy. I believe that it's no secret that his tweets move the market. I'm certain that he's doing it deliberately, and I wouldn't put it past him to deliberately put out tweets to make it go down if things aren't going his way so he can turn around and put it back up again. I wouldn't put it past him to have, he manipulates so much. I believe that he would have his billionaire buddies, you know, buying up the market as well.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. I don't know that if even the president and other wealthy people can have that much of a finger on the lever of the economy. But that said, it is true. In some cases, when the president tweets about a particular company, in particular, Tulu, the market does respond very often.
Yes, and we have seen the markets gyrate pretty wildly over the last few months, specifically over the summer. And that's part of the reason these numbers are tanking for the president, because a lot of people believe there's a lot of uncertainty in the economy that is sparked by the president. He's been on again and off again with the trade war with China. He's proposed new tariffs and then delayed them and then put them back on. He said that, you know, Chinese President Xi Jinping is an enemy of the U.S. And then he said he's my friend and we get along great and the trade talks are back on. So that's part of the reason we've seen the wild swings in the market over the last several weeks. And that's around the time that the Washington Post and ABC were doing this poll. And we see a lot of concern in among Americans that these wild swings in the market are a sign that there is going to be a recession. They're a sign that the president has not been sort of strong in handling the economy. We're seeing his numbers sort of soften in terms of his approval rating on economic issues. So I do think that the fact that there are these wild swings in the market, these are things that people are following, they're watching, and it's causing concern among a number of voters that things are likely to slow down economically in the future, and it's causing people to be concerned that the economy is not on a strong footing and that things could take a turn for the worse pretty soon.
Tolu Olorunipa is with us, White House reporter at The Washington Post, with our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. You can still join in our question this week. Do you think President Trump's policies are setting the economy up for success in the future, or are you worried about a downturn because of the president or in spite of him? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter at The Washington Post, looking at the week in national politics. Want to get to Congress now. They're back from vacation. We've seen pressure, Tolu, on Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to take action on a background check, a gun background check bill passed by the House. Today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was asked by a reporter about whether she regrets not calling the House back into session to do more on guns. Here's her response.
Senator McConnell is standing in the way. We passed our bill in February. Members had events all over the country to ask him to bring up the bill. Don't ask me what we haven't done. We have done it. And if you are annoyed with my impatience, it's because people are dying, because Senator McConnell hasn't acted. Why don't you go ask him if he has any regrets for all the people who died because he hasn't acted?
So strong words from the leader of one chamber targeted at the other, Tolu. What's going to give here?
Well, it's clear that Senator McConnell will not be taking any action until he hears from President Trump what the president will sign and what the president will support. The White House has been, they say, working behind the scenes, but so far the president has held his cards very close to the vest and has not talked about what type of policy he supports for any type of gun control or gun safety legislation. We are expecting in the next few days to hear more from the White House in terms of putting, you know, ink on paper in terms of what they support, and that could get the ball rolling on some sort of minor shifts or minor legislation. Some of the things that the Democrats want in terms of sweeping policy changes are just not going to fly with the White House and not going to fly with the Republican-controlled Senate. So we're talking about sort of things around the edges here that may get passed if the president signals his support. But the ball is definitely in the court of the White House, because Senator McConnell has said that he's not going to take any action until he gets a word from the White House. And so far, we have not heard exactly what the president will support. And he's been somewhat reluctant to take any action that would put him crosswise with the NRA. He's had multiple calls with the leadership of the NRA and trying to find out what the NRA will support or at least only mildly oppose, and that may determine how far the president's willing to go and how far Republicans are willing to go in passing anything that has to do with gun control or gun safety. So right now we're in a holding pattern until the White House decides what they can get behind.
The president at some point after a couple of the mass shootings in the summer had said he would be open to some kind of stronger background check. Is he talking that way more recently?
Yeah, he has backed down a little bit from those strong comments about wanting to do something very significant on background checks. It's clear at this point that when Democrats say the word background checks and when Republicans and the president says the word background checks, they're talking about very different things. And sort of the public is waiting to find out exactly what the White House means when they say background checks. So far, it appears that they are likely to push forward something that's much more limited than what the Democrats have already passed. The universal background checks bill that already passed out of the House earlier this year is not getting any traction in the Senate, not getting any traction with the White House. But the White House may put forward something much more limited that does expand background checks for some gun purchases, but nothing close to the universal approach that the Democrats want and that what than the Democrats passed in the House. And the president has talked about red flag laws and things that would keep guns out of the hands of the mentally unstable. It seems like that seems to be where the president is much more focused on mental illness and not on a broad process of restricting access to firearms or expanding background checks for all gun purchases the way the Democrats have proposed.
Talking to Tolu Olorunipa from The Washington Post about some of the top stories in national politics. Well, Tolu, the 2018 congressional elections finally ended yesterday, weirdly. There was a seat in North Carolina. It was a do-over after some weirdness in the actual election. Why was this one? I know there were two races. Why was this one race getting so much national attention?
Well, back in November, when there was a big blue wave and the Democrats took over control of the House, this one seat in North Carolina was one of the closest races in the country. It was a seat that President Trump had won by double digits in 2016, but it swung and almost was won by a Democrat. Only about 900 votes separated the two candidates, and there was a lot of concern, and the election was not able to be certified because of concerns over voter fraud and voter irregularities mostly on the Republican side. And they had to do another election, and one reason it was so heavily contested and so expensive was that people see this race as a bellwether for the 2020 elections. This is a district that President Trump won significantly in 2016. It includes some suburban areas that have trended towards Democrats. And last night, Democrats were able to overperform what President Trump did in 2016, but Republicans were able to hold on to the seat. So both sides got something they wanted out of it. Democrats can say that it's a sign that things have not improved for Republicans since 2018, when they took a pretty large drubbing in the House. Republicans can say that they were able to hold on to a very important seat where they were outspent by the Democratic candidate. President Trump believes that it was a sign of his strength that he was able to hold a rally on Monday night and bring voters over the finish line and help bring the Republican candidate over the finish line. So both sides got something they wanted out of this race, but it's clearly going to be a hard-fought election in 2020, because the same dynamics that powered this special election are continuing to take place. We have rural voters that are swinging to the president in large numbers, and suburban voters that are swinging away from the president and away from Republicans in large numbers. And that's creating a dynamic that's putting a lot of races in play. So it's going to be a hard-fought 2020 election in the House and the Senate and for the White House.
It seems like if anybody was looking at this one as a magic eight ball for the 2020 elections, the response is clearly reply hazy, ask again later.
That's exactly right. And it could be that if you want to see this in a positive light, you can see positive things out of it from both angles. So I imagine we're going to continue to hear a lot of spin from Republicans and a lot of spin from Democrats about this special election as they tee up their plans for pursuing the 2020 races, both in the Senate, where in North Carolina there's a Senate race, and another a few other competitive races in various states, and dozens of competitive races in the House, and several states that continue to be swing states, including North Carolina, where at the presidential level they will be pivotal in deciding whether or not Trump gets reelected or whether a Democrat is able to oust him from office.
And briefly, Tolu, as we wrap up, impeachment, the House Judiciary Committee is expected to vote sometime soon on new procedures for its inquiry. Real mixed messages coming from Democrats about whether or not they're doing anything related to impeachment, right?
Yeah, there seems to be some divisions, at least semantically, among Democrats about whether or not they are pursuing some kind of impeachment inquiry. Judiciary Committee seems to be wanting to lean in as far as possible and saying that they have begun an impeachment inquiry. Some of the Democratic leaders are saying they're still litigating and still investigating, still in the fact-gathering process. But there are a number of Democrats that are getting impatient, feeling the clock is running out, and they want to be able to tell their voters that they held the president accountable. There are a number of Democrats who feel they have plenty of information with which to start an impeachment inquiry. There are some Democrats from more swing districts who believe that they should wait and not hold an impeachment inquiry because it would be too divisive. And that's why you hear these mixed messages coming from various Democrats. They haven't been able to come to a consensus yet. And it remains to be seen whether or not they will pull the trigger and actually go forward with an impeachment hold a hearing on whether or not the president conducted and committed impeachable offenses.
Tolu, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
You got it. Thank you.
That's Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter at The Washington Post. He joined us for a look at the top stories this week in national politics. We asked for your thoughts on the president and the economy. Jim in Watertown says Trump has been strong with China. That's a good thing. If he's not reelected, it could go away. Jennifer says the tariff war may work out in the long run. Right now, it's having a negative effect. Keep sharing your thoughts. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Time now for an update on the latest news about eels. As I mentioned the other day, eels may have been the inspiration for Loch Ness monster sightings over the years, according to a DNA survey. Now, as reported in the Smithsonian Magazine, a research project finds that there are three different species of electric eels instead of just one, as previously thought. First, it turns out that the name electric eel is misleading. Not the electricity part, that's real. No, it turns out electric eels aren't really eels. They're a freshwater knife fish with the wrong name, as opposed to the true eels that live in salt water. Second, there are now three different kinds of electric eels that we know of living in different parts of South America. And third, one of those species can generate over 800 volts of electricity. Compare that to your standard car battery at 12 or 13 volts or an electric fence at 200. It's not as powerful, though, as a cattle prod or a stun gun. In the world of nature, 860 volts makes the newly classified Electrophorus voltae the most powerful bioelectric generator in the known world. So I know what you're thinking. Why hasn't there been an electric eel horror movie? Answer, there has. Deep Shock in 2003 featured giant electric eels, and Shock Attack in 2015 features some kind of mutant electric eel. I've seen neither of those movies. I assume they're high-quality productions. Also, PSA, actual eels like the moray, no electricity. It's eel news you can use here on Central Time.